This is the Urban Political,
the podcast on urban theory, research, and activism.
So hello, dear listeners. Welcome to the Urban Political podcast, where we explore stories, struggles, and visions that shape our world. Today, we remember Mark Saunders, the radical filmmaker and witness who passed away recently. For decades, he turned his camera towards the margins, the uprisings, and the untold stories that mainstream media refused to see. From the streets to the squats, from protest lines to underground screenings, Mark's work gave voice to those fighting for justice and dignity. We honor not only his films, but the uncompromising vision and courage behind them, and his friendship and his collegiality and his legacy. To help us reflect on Mark's life and legacy, I'm joined today by Kevin Sheridan, Richard Wolfe, and Laura Collini. If I can invite Kevin first to talk a little bit about Mark. Thanks for joining us, Kevin.
Thank you, Nitin. I'm Kevin Sheridan, and I was a friend of Mark's for, I don't know, some 45 years, almost 45 years. So it's come as a terrible shock to me that his passing, basically, it was so sudden and out of the blue. But I'd like to take you back really to the 80s in the UK, and in particular in East London, where we first met and we first operated. And at that time, Channel 4 had started up in the UK. It was a new channel, and it came with a radical agenda, I mean, compared with the other mainstream channels. And out of the back of that, a whole group of workshops appeared. And in the east of London, or east London, and to a certain extent the east end of London, about four particular workshops came up. One was my own, which was called Anaris Video Cooperative. We were based in Hackney, and in Tower Hamlets there was Mark's Despai TV, which was in Tower Hamlets Arts Project. Also in Tower Hamlets was the Island Barn workshop, where a woman called Karen Hamilton was working, and she was still friends with Mark when sadly he passed. And there was also the Black Film and Audio Collective, who were, you know, putting a different perspective on the portrayal of Black people within film and video. So we were all trying to do something different. And we were coming to terms with the medium and trying to understand it. But we all met together because the workshops would have a meeting organised by Channel 4. And that's how we bumped into each other. And we naturally went towards each other because we were from the same area. And rather than being competitive with each other, we found that actually we got on very well and wanted to be cooperative where we could be. And this is how my friendship with Mark first developed, because I immediately found a soulmate, if you like, you know, someone who, he wasn't egotistical in any way. It was almost vocational for him to give other people a voice, to enable their voice, to create something that was participatory. But he also loved the art of filmmaking. He was a very, very good cameraman, and he was a very, very good editor. I think it was the editing that he particularly loved. I mean, it was a very specific skill. He would sit in dark rooms for long hours, sorting and sifting through all sorts of tapes. And I explained why that was quite onerous, but he was very rigorous at it. At that time, you know, all we had was the mainstream media, really. There was some underground press and alternative voices in that way, and there were people with megaphones. But with the growth of the new technology and video, it really, you know, opened it up to a larger number of people, and for all sorts of stories to be told. And believe you me, in the east of London, there's plenty of stories to be told. It's one of the poorest parts of Britain and has been traditionally for many centuries, although these days it's getting gentrified very fast. If I look at the different approaches that we took of the three workshops, leaving aside the black film and audio one for the moment, for Anaris, it was about making the equipment and quality equipment available to as many different groups as possible who wouldn't normally get access to it. And in that case, we did a lot of work applying for grants to allow that access, and we would organise that. But we also had to do some commercial work, mostly for what I would call the soft left, if you like the local authorities and trade unions and NGOs and people like that, in order to subsidise the whole thing so that the quality of the material could become accessible to people that didn't have any funds and they could compete on that level. And we would also advise them and train them a bit in order for them to be able to produce their own films. And to that extent, we got people from all over London and outside sometimes coming to us in Hackney, you know, from the very far southwest. Now, both Mark and Karen in Island Barn and Mark in Tower Hamlets Arts Project, they were more about producing different alternative news items and doing a lot of training with people, especially young people, so that they could go out and make their own stuff and providing them with some of the equipment to be able to do that, and then bringing that all together in one load and disseminating it out to as wide an audience as possible. So they were almost like the indie media or social media of today, but on VHS, you know, and this was the beginnings of it. Now, Karen went on to work for the BBC and produce the first video diaries that were ever done by them. I mean, now reality TV is everywhere and it's used in a way that wasn't what we were envisaging, but she was doing things like The Miner's Wife, you know, in the miner's strike, or the person going back to visit the graves of his friends from the Spanish Civil War. And these were profound videos, and they were video diaries of one person. Mark developed that even further, which you see in his films like The Battle of Trafalgar, which is about the poll tax riots in Britain, and The Truth Lies in Rostock as well. Another one of his films very worth viewing is that he developed the concept of a group video diary, and almost based on one event on one day where they knew something was kicking off, and he had a train and equipped lots of people to go out and film from every possible angle, and then he would spend hours in the video suite afterwards going, tape 30, the zoom in at 5 minutes in relates to camera 3, tape 3, 17 minutes in, boom, 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 you know, and there he would edit something on that. As he went on, And I would meet with him and talk to him about practice and what he was up to. We always had great conversations where we ended up laughing most of the time, but we would discuss all the practice. What he did was he would go on an estate, like the Silwood Estate in South London, or the estates in Luton where the Exodus Collective was, and he would go there year after year after year and interview people and then interview them again. And they were projects about regeneration and about people being moved out of their communities. He did work on the people that were displaced by the Olympic Games in 2012 in London, by the people that were displaced by the Battersea Power Station development, by the loads of estates that were being regenerated all over London, often to the detriment of the people that were living there. But he would interview them and document them, and this has sort of built up an invaluable archive of material. It's almost unique in anything that I know, because like having later worked in research in research institutes in universities, the type of work that the researchers were doing, they wouldn't have this level of depth of interviews with the same people over a whole period of time. It's totally unique. I mean, I can only think of the people that did it on paper, really, the likes of Studs Terkel in America, or I forget his name now, like Tony Martin over here, who were the oral historians. And it was very much like that. And he covered all sorts of different aspects. So my work with him afterwards was included. I tried to when I got work, I always tried to use him, because I knew what he was trying to do. He was trying to keep this workshop alive, keep the training alive, build the participatory video method, and keep that alive. And it was, as I said, it wasn't for money. He needed money to keep, pay rent and get equipment and stuff like that. But he never personally benefited from it like people in the film industry do when they do so much work. So I always try to help him in that way, in my small way. So I work with him on issues like Black people's experience of the mental health system, or on light rapid transit systems in British cities. And later on, in one of the biggest public health research projects in Britain, which was called Well London, where we went into 20 different boroughs in London to the most deprived, I hate that word, but the most deprived by the index of multiple deprivation, deprived areas, neighbourhoods, estates in that area. And Mark would follow us in and create an archive and need training with the people in the local area so that they could have a voice. I'll finish off because I know that other people will have other things to say about Mark. But for me, I'm still struggling with the fact that it was so sudden, it shouldn't have happened. And he's passed away. A guy of great integrity, of, egoless, really. And, who believed in what he was doing. And like the rest of us who started in the 80s, and at the same time was a lovely bloke who I'm going to miss. I'm just thinking forward now, feeling very sad that I won't get to have a chat with him again. It was sometimes we didn't chat to each other, because when we started, it went on for hours. So we would time it very well. And I'm going to miss those dreadfully. I'm going to miss those moments of friendship and humour, comradeship, so much. And I'd suggest to anybody who doesn't know Mark's work to seek it out at, you know, his website on Spectacle Productions, and have to just get a flavour of some of it. You know, it's a fantastic history of urban Britain and beyond. I think that's all for now, Nitin, and I'll come back if you've got any questions.
Thanks a lot, Kevin. That was very touching. Richard, would you like to follow up, maybe?
Yes. I thank you, Kevin, for telling the story starting in the 80s, maybe also focusing on the 80s and showing how Mark developed his work in London and what kind of work he did in London, working together with communities, working for the communities, making people participate in telling their stories. And that's what I will, I think, pick up and continue for what I know about Mark in the 90s. My name is Richard Wolf. I was trained as an urban geographer. I had my own small consultancy, planning consultancy in Zurich. And I was always interested in international cooperation, in learning and knowing more about global trends, global events happening all over the world in urban development, and how people act to improve living conditions in cities. So that was my start. And luckily, we had a strong group of similar thinking people in Zurich. And we had the idea to form an international network for urban research and action in the early 1990s. And we invited people from all over the world, from people that helped us collect addresses about similarly thinking people in other parts of the world. So we invited these people in 1991 to get together in the Swiss Alps in a place called Salecina. And that's where we started this network. And that's exactly when and where I got to know Mark Saunders. I can't really trace back the exact details of how he got into the network, but obviously we have had some common friends and contacts in London and in on the continent in Europe. He came to the mountains and we together founded this network. We were about 20 people in that place, and with us sharing the same idea of forming a network, forming a space, forming a room to talk and interchange views and experiences between people working on the theory of urban development and people working in practice, activists. So what we said is we bring together research and action, theorists, academics on one side, and activists and practitioners on the other side. And very often we found people that were involved in both. And most of the people came a bit more from the academic side, and other people came more from the activist side. But we all shared this interest of bringing together the two like aspects or the two motors of change in urban development, in urban situations. So that's how I got to know Mark. And Mark, to me, I like to apply this term of the organic intellectual. Like he was also an academic, but he was much more a practitioner and an activist, but with very much theoretical knowledge and theoretical interest. So he came there to listen what the more academic people would say about urban development, but what he would do would be the ideal of the academics to really translate what we were thinking into images and bringing it much closer to the people or to the common people or to even to TV watchers, people that would watch films. So he was a very excellent communicator, I think. And he did that what many people inside Inora would have loved to do, to translate their theory into action. And he was something like the model, the model for an Inora member. And that's what he impersonated also. He was like a paratypical member. He was a great and important figure in Inora and a friend to many of us. And he also brought in other activists. For example, he brought in the Exodus Collective, and that was a very, very important move. He had got to know this squatter, raver collective north of London. He had been documenting their activities for a long time, and he brought them into Inora, and he brought them over to Holland for an Inora conference. And that's where all these academics and other activists got to know this Exodus Collective. And that was a very, very interesting and important, I would say, a crucial encounter for the further development of Inora. For me, Mark was, as I already said, he was a filmmaker, but he was more than a filmmaker because he was involving people, helping them express and change their lives inside communities, and communicating what were their views, their perspectives, and showing them how they could use cameras, for example, to express themselves. So like you mentioned the word participation, and I think that was a very, very crucial thing. He made people able to participate in their urban environment. And he would also train them. And I think this was a very important part of his work, is training people, teaching people how to use cameras, so that even lay people, people that had no really technical experience, would in quite a short time develop enough capabilities to use cameras in a way, in a semi-professional way. I mean, he would include the images, like you mentioned, in the case of the Battle of Trafalgar, in the poll tax riots. He would use the film material that lay people or just freshly trained people had shot to include them in a TV program. In a documentary film. So that was high quality participatory and inclusive work by affected people, by affected and not just affected, but people that became active out of their local experiences. So training was important, participation was important, and his personality was really important. Like his total commitment, you mentioned it, money was not really an issue. It was a problem of getting enough money for what he wanted to do. That was constant. I think that was throughout his life. But he always somehow, I never understood it. I never understood how he did it, but he managed to somehow make a livelihood out of his work and make all these great documentaries. And the material that has not become documentary yet, that he has thousands of hours of documents about various projects, movements, communities in London, but also abroad, in Rostock, in Eastern Germany, where he made a very, very important film for the German history, really, about the pogroms against so-called guest workers after the fall of the Berlin Wall in East Germany, a very important history that he has material no one else really had ever taped. And so this film is still used and shown in many occasions in Germany especially, but it was also shown on international television stations. And he also became a documentarist for Inura history, because he was with his camera in many occasions. He came to conferences and made interviews with people of Inura. He just filmed some of the conferences, some of the discussions, many images of places that we visited. So for Inura, for the history of Inura, for the biography of the network, his work was also very important. But the other aspect for me, of course, he became a very, very good friend, because like you already said, soulmate, I think, is the word. He was a soulmate for me because he shared so many interests, and he had a good humor. And that makes it very important, I think, for the kind of friendships that I like, is to have the humor in it also, to be able to laugh even though stuff is really serious and maybe sad or maybe scandalous and maybe terrible, but still have the ability in between to cheer up and also see absurd or funny or curious things, and to have not just in-depth and very, very serious conversations, but also some maybe superficial or in-between chats and laughs. And he was good company, so people felt good with him. He could make people feel good. And now I'm getting a bit emotional. So I think I'd rather pass the word on, and maybe we can come back to one or two things that we want to go into more in depth. And now one thing I wanted to mention, I was with him a week before he passed away. We were in this conference in Tampere, one of the 33rd or 34th Inura conference held this year in Finland, in Tampere, and we walked around the city and we talked and we shared so many meals and bus rides and whatever we did there. It's impossible to imagine like 1 week later what happened. So that was very, very emotional at that time. Laura, please.
Thank you very much, Nitin, for organizing this podcast. And also thank you very much for making listeners curious, I hope, about the work of Mark, about Mark's commitments and endeavor of his life. I'm honored to also to speak here, and also I represent myself, but somehow also the voices of many people within Inura that admired and were inspired by Mark, not only by his work. I want to tell a little bit about how I met him. I met his work before meeting Mark, because his work was presented at an Inura meeting in Florence at the university where I was a student at that time. And in one of the rooms of the university, they showed a video about a McDonald's, like a Big Mac, not the building, actually the real Big Mac, that was open up like it would be a mouth of a dentist. And then there was the dentist instruments going inside, and that was the video, all of it, and making it really look disgusting. I was like, what kind of video is that? Who's doing this? And why in the Department of Urban Studies? And then I got curious about this, and I got involved at Inura, Richard has been talking about, which is a strange group of people that are like-minded. They meet each other once in the year. And we exchange ideas about our activism, our things that are on our hearts that we explain through academic work or through cameras or other things, writing as well with different talents. And Mark had the great talent of exposing and politicizing not only as a director, but really as somebody that generously and intellectually can do empirical research, having the voices of people that are directly affected by injustice. And he did that in many different ways. I mean, one of the last time I met, I spent time with Marek was watching his long feature movie about Rostock, the one that Richard was talking about. The title of the movie is The Truth Lies in Rostock. It's about an event in the Lichtenhagen state in 1992, where Vietnamese guest workers were living. And I remember Mark saying that by chance, because he found himself in organizing workshop also through connections, through also interest and through inspiration. So I think he had been working with this people, with this inhabitants, not long before. So people had really learned, had the skills to do video making. And so what happens that during the attack with fascists and racist neo-Nazis, people could film from inside what was happening. Really an absolute unique testimony of violence and injustice happening. And I know that people from Inora, also Britta Grell and other people from Germany, helped Mark to reconstruct everything that happened that night, and also to make a case that the police did not do enough. The situation was silenced institutionally. And that document was an extremely important work, because it was a work where people could actually reclaim the rights to be listened, and to be listened with scientific analysis. So absolutely a precious work. And then while preparing for this discussion, for this podcast, I was thinking, what can I say that is still up to date beyond the affection and the loss and the sadness and even the injustice to lose somebody like Mark too early, can speak to me and to other people. There is this wonderful spectacle archive online that people can look at, also on YouTube videos. There is one that is about the Kilner House. The Kilner House story, it's a story that we all know also from the literature about selling council housing in London. And I don't know if it was directly Mark or some people working with him, but it's all somehow the same thing, because that was the community type of work and really participatory video making work. So the people that somebody interviews the tenants, and they said, what do you think about selling out the council house? And the woman says very clearly, no, they shouldn't. Those houses need to be rented out to people. They are waiting for flats. If they are sold, these people, they're privatized this flat, it's all wrong. So it's very simple, but it starts with this story of the Kilner House. And I looked online, what happened with Kilner House today, Clayton Street, and there is an announcement of one-bedroom apartment sold for £370,000. So things that have been shot end of the 80s and 90s are like a testimony that things have not changed, that this housing crisis has not changed. There is another video by Mark talking about homelessness in the Hackney Festival in 1993. One of the speakers says, we cannot see that. It cannot happen that people go living in the street. More than 70,000 people in Europe sleep rough every night. I think the statistics are even before COVID. Now it's even more. So, and that was in 1993, still very actual. Of course, another important work that Mark was talking about all the time when we were at Inora, it came out every now and then, because also was a long film. I think that it took many years to do the film on the Battersea power station. And one of the speakers says, one of the interviewees says, I think it's nice to let also this speaker speak for Mark. There was the speaker saying no consultation. There hasn't been any consultation in the regeneration of the Battersea power station, and they said there was no consultation. Everything happened behind closed door. There are about 600 documents concerning this building, and nobody can actually review everything. So these things are going to slip by. So the idea that even the decision that concerns the cities, the things that they are on our heart and the people that listen to the podcast, that kept silenced. And I think the work of Mark talking to people and showing and exposing was a continuous and very crucial and important work that needs to be done today. Another part of this videos that I was looking at for this podcast is about the documentary about Murray Bookchin. And I think Kevin was mentioning this. Mark was interested in this utopianism and the urban experience, not for being not necessarily urban, but not a negative experience. And it opens up, and I think he's chosen this sentence to open up the documentary movie, says, with Murray saying, "I believe in human activity. I believe that human beings should change the world. I believe they could change the world rationally from an ecological standpoint and from a social standpoint." And I think that was also the soul of Mark, of investing his life and his work and his passion on it. Last but not least, very, very personal. When I joined Inura, I was doing some video myself, and I was collecting stories of people in migrant people from the US, and it was like a digital storytelling, we call it that time. So it was extremely inspiring for me, the work of Mark. I was one of the Paul at Inura, and I was hoping to sit close to him because I was waiting for the outburst of laughter, which came in between all these very important discussions that we were having about urban and social justice. And I think I bring in many, many thoughts from Inura, from many people that had the chance really to sit close to him. And of course, my greetings go to his family as well.
Thanks, thanks, Kevin. Thanks, Richie. Thanks, Laura, for sharing these stories from Mark's life and like his really rich legacy. I'm quite touched, and I'm sure the listeners who don't know Mark would look up his work. And I mean, me being a filmmaker as well, like I really look up to Mark and his work, and I've been always inspired. We were trying to work on a film actually together. We were applying for some. I mean, he has the video archive of that film. It must be lying around on his desk somewhere. But I think when I do finish that film, that would be dedicated to Mark for sure. I want to talk about perhaps in these final minutes of this podcast about his legacy. What are you doing to preserve his archives, or like how are you sort of leaving it on for future generations and for all of us?
A group of us have come together to try and save this amazing archive that Mark has. I mean, there's just, as been said, you know, hundreds of hours of video, both the masters and the raw tapes. There's audio tapes. There's all sorts of different formats. There's documentation, you know, paper documentation that goes with a lot of the regeneration. He was very methodical at collecting stuff like leaflets or posters that were put out on estates about the reports of the regenerations that were going on, for instance. And he's got magazines and stuff like that. Laura mentioned Kilner House, for instance. I was actually there when they evicted Kilner House. I remember it well. So we've come together to try and save this. It was very sudden, the way that Mark passed away. It wasn't a long thing. It wasn't expected. He got some sepsis and he went. And so it was out of the blue. People were talking to him days before, the previous day. And everything seemed okay. But this leaves him, all his stuff, which in a workshop, which he was keeping alive, keeping afloat through his training work and various other projects and stuff that he was doing. He was keeping it alive, but he's gone. And so a group of us have come together to try and look at how the finances are, what projects were in place and need to carry on, but most importantly, to save this incredible archive of 45 years worth of material. And as I said in my first piece, if you like, that he went back to estates, for instance, over and over again, over 10 to 20 years in some cases. It's unique. And what we've found is that a lot of it's been digitized now, but there's still a lot that hasn't been. And we're looking to move it to a cheaper place, downsize the space a bit, carry on the digitization, and then make the archive accessible. There's all sorts of problems and issues, which I'm sure we're overcome. But, you know, with that, because there's things about consent and about copyright and stuff like that. But I think all of these things are overcomable. It's not a proper word, but, and we can make that archive accessible to a lot of people and also carry on some of that work of participatory video making. So, for instance, crowd editing, crowd archiving, crowd tagging of this video. So that's what we're at the moment. We were brought together by his partner Ilka, his longtime partner Ilka, his wife basically, who had less to do with that side of things, and she knew that we could all make a contribution in some way. And so we've got quite an amazing sort of team of people actually come together. But if anybody wants to make a contribution or a donation to keeping the archive together, then I really, really would be appreciated. And maybe if they go through you, Nitin, to say, where can we get in contact, or through Richard, we can talk to them. But that's what we're trying to do. We cannot lose this archive. It's invaluable and it's unique and it's wonderful.
Maybe I can just add a few words to this. The uniqueness of the archive, I think that has been, it's underestimated because it's not so well known. But the material that he has collected over the last 45 years, you say?
Yeah, 45 years, I think.
The amount of material he has collected on so many different types of community initiatives, and the voices that he has collected, and the examples of urban development issues that he has collected, I think is very, very unique. And that has to be highlighted and maybe not commercialized, but advertised, made known much, much more. And as we work on this, I'm part of this group also that's trying to keep the archive together and accessible. As we work on this, we have to find a way, a format, a form. We may have to create our own trust or initiative or company. It depends on where you come from, what you want to call it, but a kind of an institution, because we're not there yet. we're trying to search for a good solution, but to add it to an existing archive seems to be quite a difficult issue, because many of the existing archives, they're not very interested in having more material because they don't have the resources to absorb more, no matter what the value is of the collection of data and of information. They just don't have the capacity to include this, and we don't want to make any compromises about the material that we would have offer, make it accessible. So we may have to find our own solution, but we're still working on this. I'm just telling you that I think there is a necessity and there's a will. And what's amazing and what surprised me a lot is how many people like Kevin and many other people I had not heard of before are still around, people that have worked with Mark maybe quite a long time ago, but they're still there and they're attached to Mark, and they're attached to his ideas, and they're attached to the material that he's produced, and they're dedicated and committed to invest time, to invest ideas, to keep what Mark has assembled, what he brought together for to keep this and continue this into the future. And I'm very happy that I met all these people who I did not know before. And it looks like we will find a solution. We will find a good solution. And the meeting is on actually pretty much after this meeting. As we talk here in another 2 hours, we will be talking in another different setup of people about the future of the archives.
I was thinking that the archive that is already online, it's divided into section, no? Into the thematic section. And I was surprised to see how many videos are of protests. Usually, you know, possibly the most ephemeral events, the last few hours. And usually we have them covered by journalists and covered with pictures most of the time. And rarely we have interviews of the people that explain why they are protesting and what they are protesting. One was on gender pay gap. One was on the right to housing. Others, you know, very, very different topics. And I think this is also a unique type of video, which is unworked, unedited, but is really in the line of what we were saying of this exposing, like hyper-exposures of people with no name sometimes, but they were involved in activism, in social justice movements, and such activities. So I think potential interest should be on the side of people that do research, historians, universities. They should be absolutely involved in having this, as Kevin has been repeating several times, but it's really true, this unique source of empirical information which concern human history as well. So yeah, so it's very important to keep this alive and open to everyone, and open to grow as well.
I couldn't agree more with the last two comments from Richard and Laura. I mean, I've worked in universities as a community engagement person, so I go onto the estates and the researchers follow me in afterwards, so I get to understand what they're looking for. And this archive is full of that information. I mean, it's not just that. I mean, it's great to look at the changing fashions over the last 45 years on demonstrations, for instance. I used to be one of the only people that made my own placards, and now everybody seems to be doing it. But there's such a variety of stuff in the archive. I would love personally to sort of, you know, be able to work on some of the urban regeneration stuff, because it's just such a resource. I'm going to repeat myself now, you know, it really is unique. I think people, like Laura said, should go and try and explore through the type of stuff that Mark has been making. I think that someone one day might do something on, you know, the bursting out of alternative media that started, well, it didn't start in the 80s, but it came out very strongly in the 80s, of which Mark was part of that and an important part of it. It tends to, the history of these things tends to get dominated by one or two people who are self-publicists in a way. I don't want to put them down, you know, they're doing what they're telling a story, but and people like Mark, who were so important to those movements, quietly slip into the ether when actually they were the ones that were pushing the margins of what Richard was talking about, participatory video practice. And we can't afford to lose this stuff. We must save this stuff for his legacy and for all people's legacy. You know, that this is part of our social history, as Laura said, and we've got to keep that alive.
Thanks a lot, Kevin. Thanks a lot, Richard. Thanks a lot, Laura, for these beautiful words about Mark and bringing him to listeners who might have not even heard about him. And I hope people who know him remember and use this podcast to remember his life and work, and people who haven't heard about him learn about his work more. Thanks a lot for taking the time, and thanks for listening to this podcast.
Thanks to you for listening.
For more information, visit our website urbanpolitical.podigee.io.